So an anxiety disorder, it's a range of illnesses that few understand that are totally different than, you know, anxiety. It comes with distress, dread, and doom. And it's always persuasive. It's usually pervasive. It's either acutely exhausting or exhaustingly time-consuming. And it's relentless in its ability to turn ability and opportunity into paralysis and guilt. But it's treatable.
Welcome to the Highway to Higher Ed, the podcast that considers issues facing students applying to college as they attempt to make the transition into higher education. I'm your host, Alex W. Merrill. In the last episode, we focused on small liberal arts schools in the Midwest. We now turn to a different, perhaps much broader segment of the student population. Those students suffering from anxiety and related disorders. We'll be focusing particularly on navigating the many challenges presented to those non-traditional path students, as it can be fairly complex for parents. I'll be joined by Dr. Dan Villiers of the Anxiety Institute in his second appearance on this podcast. Dr. Dan brings over 20 years of experience working with children, adolescents, young adults, and families in a range of clinical and educational settings. In 2011, Dr. Dan co-founded Mountain Valley Treatment Center, the first non-hospital residential program for the treatment of adolescent anxiety in the United States. His successful intervention model, a compassionate approach, to assess, educate, and motivate avoidant and resistant school-aged anxiety sufferers has assisted more than 500 families in their pursuit of treatment. Dr. Dan has presented at universities and conferences across the country, authored numerous articles on child mental health, and appeared on radio and TV as a subject matter expert on adolescent anxiety.
I'm from England originally. I moved to the United States when I was about 14. I went to a high school in California. And during my junior year of high school, I started to struggle with anxiety, which was at that time kind of moderate to severe. I didn't really know what it was. I actually thought that I was maybe getting sick or I had some virus. And I just noticed that I wanted to sort of leave social situations when I was uncomfortable, very anxious to speak in front of the school. There was a sort of school meeting, class meeting that we'd have on the pergola. This is the Thatcher School in California. And we'd have to make announcements. And I remember just dreading all night to make an announcement the next day. When I was a young kid, I had separation anxiety. I was pretty dependent on my parents to do a lot of things for me or to, you know, whether it was getting on the phone and ordering some food or, you know, ordering something in a restaurant, protecting me in my view is how I saw it. Really, they were just helping me, you know, and then they became dependent on helping me because they saw that, you know, it elicited some comfort. You know, as a parent, I'm a parent, you're a parent, we love our kids and we don't want them to experience difficult emotions or uncomfortable situations. I understand how easily they slipped into that role, kind of helping too much, really. You know, as high school went on, that kind of grew. Anxiety is really like a virus, and it starts to infect different parts of one's life if untreated, and certainly if unrecognized, which was my situation. There was a few sort of incidents or episodes where it really was bad, and I think they were full-blown panic attacks. Looking back now, I didn't know this at the time, obviously, where it wasn't just, okay, I'm a little uncomfortable, I'm going to leave. I'm absolutely terrified. I have this sense of impending doom. And not only do I need to leave, but I do not want to go back. And that's really when anxiety becomes an anxiety disorder, when you're not just escaping, but you're avoiding. And that avoidance and escape perpetuates and gets worse and starts to spread into different areas of your life, social, academic. You know, I had a whole list of things that I could come up with.
The term anxiety is something that's kind of thrown around a lot. It's like, I feel anxious about climate change or And when I say that, I just mean, well, I feel a little bit nervous about it. But that's interesting that that's where you sort of demarcate the difference between a clinical form of anxiety and just like feeling nervous.
Yeah, absolutely. That was back then, or at least a few years after, looking back in hindsight, you know, when I discovered, okay, this is anxiety. Now as a clinician, I see anxiety and an anxiety disorder at an even deeper sense. It's more demarcated now. So anxiety, and this I say to this to clients that I work with, and the goal is with working with a client is to, you know, not just educate and hopefully help, but really find a forge a path that you can emotionally connect with them. And the way to do that when you're treating pretty severe anxiety, which comes with fear, comes with doubt of doing therapy, seeing therapy, believing in therapy, I use some language like this. I'll say, you know, normal anxiety, you know, the anxiety that everyone has, small A anxiety, is more related to stress and distress, and it's typically temporary. It's mostly manageable. It's usually negotiable, and it's minimally life interfering. And really what that touches on and speaks to is that, you know, it's temporary, it's manageable, and it's going to go. So, and really that's the definition of normal mood issues versus depression is the extent to which it impacts, you know, social, emotional, occupational, academic functioning. So an anxiety disorder, it's a range of illnesses that few understand that are totally different than, you know, anxiety. It comes with distress, dread, and doom. And it's always pervasive. It's usually pervasive. It's either acutely exhausting or exhaustingly time-consuming, and it's relentless in its ability to turn ability and opportunity into paralysis and guilt, but it's treatable. So, you know, by communicating that language, often it's the first time that a client that I'm working with will feel like this guy understands what I'm going through, that if I can control it, I would, I'm not stupid. And that is really the gateway for a really good therapeutic alliance and the start of the change and faith in the therapeutic process that's required.
That makes a lot of sense. Being able to see the work of the Anxiety Institute in the way that I have, it's remarkable, really, the turnarounds that you are able to elicit in some of these kids that are really coming in quite crippled and really just getting a chance to kind of catch their breaths and get their footing. The turnarounds of some of those kids, it's really inspiring.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, 87% of our students go from, if not housebound, some are housebound where they're not leaving the home. Mostly their world has gotten smaller. So they're avoiding, you know, a number of key things in their life. And once they go through our treatment, which is typically 6 to 8 weeks, 87% return to the same school and stay in that school at 6-12 month outcomes. So, you know, there are a lot of programs out there and I've worked at a number of them and it's great to see a student at graduation or at the end of treatment looking better, sounding better, saying everything's going to be fine. That's not good enough for us. We need to prove readiness versus hedge readiness. And how do we do that? One factor is partnering with Alliance as an example, because we need to prove academic readiness while they're in treatment. It's all about, you know, good exposure work. It's not telling a client, okay, I want you to face this fear after the session or on your own. No, we've got to do this in real time together. We're inducing anxiety. That's what we do, is induce anxiety in a gradual, controlled way. And we need access to your academics. We need access to a safe social environment and community. And we have a cohort of very carefully selected students that our clients can interact with and kind of practice those skills in real life situations and scenarios. It's a full immersion program that absolutely has transformative outcomes.
Yeah, you mentioned that. I mean, it's your IOP, and you know, at the heart of it is exposure therapy. Could you just kind of give us a little, you know, a summary of what that's all about?
So I will say, so our program is primarily an IOP. We specialize in anxiety and OCD. The anxiety disorders and OCD, so that includes social anxiety, panic disorder, fears and phobias, could be trichotillomania, or, you know, hair pulling, skin picking. And what really connects all of our students is three things: anxiety, so symptoms of anxiety, fear, which is connected to that, and a way of coping, which is either escape, avoidance, or seeking reassurance. And exposure therapy really what that's about is a two-part process. One is identifying what the fears are, because if there are symptoms of anxiety and there is no fear, it's not anxiety. It's sort of a general rule of thumb that most people don't know. So some people might present with all these sort of physiological symptoms of anxiety and acute stress, and if they're not connecting that with a fear, we really want to do some other assessment, and maybe we recommend them to do some medical tests to see if it's something organic. So identifying what we call the variables of influence, and that could include anything from person, place, time, situation. So let's say I was working, and I often use this as an example, is public speaking anxiety. A lot of people have it. A lot of our students have it, especially if they have social anxiety. Giving that as an example, right? Your variables of influence might be, you know, the number of people in the room, the size of the room. Have you given this talk before? If you did, the last time you gave that talk, were you very anxious? Was it internal anxiety that only you just realized? Or was it sort of visible anxiety that other people realized? What are your own perceived or real expectations of that presentation? What are your perceived expectations of yourself for that presentation versus the perceived expectation of others? How much did you practice that presentation? And so it's finding out all those, and there's a macro variables, there are micro variables to how much sleep you got, the comfort that the clothes that you picked, to your location of the on the stage, or did you visit that place before in preparation? So by having all those variables, it's critical we know, and there's going to be hundreds for every situation, we're able to provide a very targeted intervention, which is putting someone in a situation that will elicit anxiety, which is the exposure part, exposing them to that sensation of doom and dread, and but in a controlled way. So knowing those variables of influence, we can control that intervention and do that exposure at a just tolerable level. We don't want to flood them and, you know, fear of spiders. It's not throwing them in a vat of spiders. Based on our knowledge of you and your fear and the relationship of trust that we've developed, today we are going to have you imagine going to a place that may have a spider in a glass cage. That might be the exposure of the day. And then certainly, yes, a month later might be, we're going to, you know, have a spider in your hand that's non-venomous.
Right. Right.
Or poisonous.
Right.
Or,
gradual exposure, right? So you're kind of building up tolerance over time.
Yeah, very much so. And the real skill, and it's the art and science of this work, is grading it at a very sort of scientific and customized, individualized level, where you're controlling the pace and the content of those exposures. The pace is the speed at which you're going, and the content is what you're selecting. Because a child with anxiety, they are terrified to do this work. They don't want to do it. But I tell my clients that we're going to go at the pace that your anxiety will allow. We're not going to push you into doing something that you're not ready for. Playing the long game here, and we're in this together. We're going to achieve the recovery together, and we have to grade it appropriately, that pace and content. So
there's an art to that, isn't there? I mean, it's not a science. I think every case is a bit different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really the basis of the model is very scientific and evidence-based and empirically supported. But the art is the delivery, the timing of when you bring up something and how you describe the process is more the art of it.
So could you kind of take us through putting my child in this IOP? What's kind of the typical, you know, what's the typical profile of a student, and, you know, how does that kind of go down?
So let's say you had a 16-year-old child, and, you know, typically we hear from the parent first. They've often talked to a lot of people. The child has seen a number of therapists. That's all very normal. You don't come to an intensive day program having tried nothing. They may have tried medications, and it either hasn't worked at all or not at a level that they would have hoped, and it's still impacting the child's life at a certain severe level. So I have a pre-screen call with the parents, which is basically, you know, on my end, I want to make sure that they are the child's potentially a right fit. And I do that by getting information from the parents, background information. The three things we are looking for is trying to understand the nature of the anxiety, which is what is the anxiety, what disorder it is potentially, the experience, what the experience is like for that child and that family system. It's a family system experience, and we need to factually understand it, emotionally understand what that experience is like for the parent and their child from the parent's perspective in that first call. And then certainly the impact. So the nature of the anxiety, the experience and the impact. How does your child's anxiety and fear and avoidance impact their life? Do they go to school? Has the world gotten smaller? Are they coming home at the end of the day and just playing video games? That's the purpose of the call, really, to learn about the child, to assess whether they might be a good fit for us. Also a great opportunity for me to talk about the Anxiety Institute and the program and what it would look like for their child. We're not just an IOP. We provide intensive treatment anywhere from 2 hours a week to 4 hours a day. We're really maximizing the benefit of intensity. So intensive treatment over a short period of time is so much better than weekly treatment over a longer period of time. As with any skill development, we're turning skills into habits and, yeah, habituating new behaviors. So I always say to parents, I want the same outcome as you. I want your child to be back on track. I want them to become the child they used to be, they could be. And if it's not right, I'm going to help you to find the right program.
And you refer a lot of these potential clients out. I mean,
I do, yeah. Actually, at 60% of the calls that we get, we refer to other providers because I like to see myself not as an admissions person for the Anxiety Institute, but as an anxiety consultant to help parents for no cost, a service, you know, a treatment that I found when I was younger, but I didn't have anyone to help find it for me.
Assuming you do accept that, you know, potential new client in, how long does that usually last? You know, what is it?
Yeah, there's a few more steps. So the admissions process can be lengthy. I mean, it can be anywhere from 3-4 days to a couple of weeks because not only are we educating the parents and about the program and doing our due diligence to make sure that their child is a really good clinical fit, personality fit, but we're also working through a lot of fear, sometimes resistance, doubt. It's an expensive program, so there, you know, there's a lot of sort of cost benefit analysis that's done. The next step, actually, if in that pre-screen meeting we feel that this child is a good fit, we'll do an in-person assessment where the student and parents will come in and visit. They'll sit with our clinical director. We have 3 current locations open: one in Greenwich, Connecticut; one in Madison, New Jersey; and one in Boca Raton, Florida. And they would come in and meet with that clinical director for about an hour. And basically kind of see the place and have a clinical interview, but in a kind of an informal conversational way, because we really don't want a child to feel like, because I'm visiting, I have to do this. No, because I'm visiting, I have the ability to make an informed decision about my treatment and my, you know, what I want and what I need. They've got to feel in control, parents and students, through the process. So I see the gradual exposure process in reality, starting at point of inquiry, that first phone call when a parent's calling me, that's the start of the exposure therapy process in some ways, because we're initially exposing them to information, an idea, and then ultimately a visit, so they can expose them to the location and then to the therapist, so that both of us can make the best informed decision based on what we know versus don't know, based on experience. And then someone can really start within a few days of that time. And it's 5 days a week, 4 hours a day. So Monday through Friday, there is 2 schedules, 9 to 1 and 11 to 3. I will give you an example. Over the summer, we had students that came for 3 weeks, 15 days of treatment, and had a remarkable experience. Now, these students were able to get through the school year despite their anxiety. So the acuity wasn't at that level where they required 2 months, which is an indicator of our sort of mission and model is that we're going to titrate the intensity based on what's needed, what's working, what's beneficial. We may start at 5 days a week and go down to 3 days a week, or start at 4 hours a week and go up to 4 hours a day. We don't want to waste time. We don't want to waste money. We want to make data-based decisions and recommendations. But yeah, I would say 80-90% are doing the program for 6 to 8 weeks. And then they do about a month of aftercare, which is a few hours a week of aftercare treatment.
And there's the graduation.
Yeah. It's a really cool experience and something that in the first program that I started called Mountain Valley in New Hampshire, I co-founded that with several wonderful colleagues, one of whom was Carl Lovejoy, who basically initiated this graduation process for us, our graduating students in at Mountain Valley. And it worked so well, it was something that we incorporated into this exposure therapy model where students would start, you know, preparing this presentation in front of all the students and their parents on the day that they graduate. You know, the real language is discharge from treatment. That's not that appealing, nor acknowledges the incredible accomplishment and mountain they've climbed. So thanks to Carl, we got that great idea and I brought it to the Anxiety Institute and it's been wonderful. And it's really the culmination of a lot of hard work, of a huge amount of fear and anxiety they've overcome. And they've really become kind of warriors at the end, and they've slayed the dragon and they're up there and they're presenting on their life experience with anxiety and where they're at now and the life that they are now able to live because of the treatment that they had. So it inspires and motivates everyone in that room.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for that that summary. I mean, I think it's hard to sometimes, I think, picture these things when you're a parent and you're kind of facing these challenges. Because I think, the kids that do end up going through that IOP certainly fit a certain prototype that, is a successful one in a lot of cases. But I don't think it's one that's like, it's not a familiar story. You know, it can feel very sort of isolating and like, you know, I'm the only one who has a kid like this, or particularly in, you know, the post-pandemic really era when isolation has become a major problem for parents and for kids.
Prior to COVID, the state of anxiety disorders in America, probably around the world, but I can only speak to this country, was already epidemic. The real epidemic, I believe, started in 2010. There are a number of factors of why, but a big factor was the invention of the smartphone and release of that. And boy, did the rates change. I mean, it was a real sizable increase, really going from 13, 14% to 20%, 22% prevalence rates. And then COVID comes around and, you know, some students that maybe had social anxiety, panic disorder, agoraphobia. And I want to clarify what agoraphobia is because it's misunderstood, but agoraphobia is a fear of getting anxious. It's a fear of not being able to escape if you get anxious. It's a fear of being a long way away from a safe place. If you had one of those conditions, it might have been a bit of relief. You know, I can kind of stay home and avoid, and I've got an excuse. It was really difficult depending on the nature of their anxiety. But anyway, the rates really skyrocketed. We saw a huge increase of OCD. And I think I talked about that in the last podcast we did together.
Was that increase during the pandemic or when the pandemic was ending? Because I feel like those are two different eras.
Yeah. We could do a whole podcast on the developmental trajectory of anxiety pre, during, posting, COVID quarantine period had its own features. But yeah, overall, there was an increase of need. It has decreased a little. Now everyone is sort of, most people are settled back into school. There's less uncertainty. You know, anxiety is about perceived threat, right? And the one time in a lot of these kids' human history, there was a real threat that was global. It's like, I told you, Mom, I told you, Dad, I told you we should be worried. I told you this is the reason I was washing my hands 50 times a day until they were bleeding. But no, isolation is sort of breeds anxiety. If you have OCD perfectionism or you have generalized anxiety, empty time and space will fuel. If you have social anxiety, panic disorder, that isolation will increase your dependence on avoidance, which is like a drug.
Here are a couple of things that stuck out to me after the first segment of my conversation with Dr. Band. I think it's a really key distinction that he made in terms of what distinguishes small anxiety and the clinical version in defining it as something that really interferes with one's life, that escapism, that avoidance. Defining it in terms of its impact, you know, on one's life, I think is the most helpful way to put it. And for the kids that Anxiety Institute is looking at, that makes it quite clear that really needs to be addressed versus something that's a normal condition of everyday life. Another thing that stuck out to me in the first segment of my conversation with Dan was that exposure model that he described, really gradually increasing the tolerance toward the source of anxiety puts that student in the driver's seat and makes them sort of the architect of their own future in ways that perhaps traditional therapeutic models might not. Being heard and seeking the source of one's problems, whether it was, in childhood or, returning to previous trauma. But I don't think it's quite as proactive as that gradual exposure model that is in their control. What are the benefits of unplugging from schooling for those students that are perhaps facing an IOP or a more intense regimen? Is it helpful? Is it necessary? Just your thoughts on that.
So that's the most common question we get from parents is, okay, my child has severe anxiety. It's impacting school. How do I know that I should pull them out of school for 2 months to do your treatment program? And the reality is it's not as black and white as that. Yes, there are certain situations due to the severity, the intensity, the impact of symptoms where a student does need to actually just completely withdraw from school and just do treatment. Certainly a possibility. I will say that's only about 20% of students that we work with in the IOP. The other 80% of students are coming for 2 months of treatment, but they are doing some academic work. They're maybe taking 2 out of 5 classes, or they're taking all of them with us collaborating with a place like Alliance Tutoring to do this treatment well and to prepare our students to prove that this treatment is working and that they're going to be ready and we're going to prevent relapse. We have to include academics. We would be a bad program if we didn't. Because anxiety always impacts academics. We don't want kids getting behind. I use the example of, if you've had you're an athlete, you've had an injury, it's more than just taking a painkiller or a anti-inflammatory. You've got to do the physical therapy and you've got to do more than that. You've got to get back on the field 5 minutes at a time and then 10 minutes at a time. You've got to have access to the field. You've got to have access to those variables of influence that, played such a role in putting you in that dark hole in the first place, because we are reconditioning that not only the skills and the abilities related to, social interaction, academic work, but we're developing the confidence that comes with that. So we can't successfully treat anxiety unless we partner with a program like Alliance Tutoring to create an academic program in tandem with the Anxiety Institute, so it can be truly a full immersion program. Because when a condition impacts social, emotional, academic functioning, if we are not engaging our student in those three domains in real life, we're not going to have a lasting impact. And that's probably why a lot of the parents that we've worked with have not seen the recovery from other forms of treatment.
Are you able to sort of, have the academic and therapeutic, components of recovery work together? I mean, is that something that you're able to provide with Anxiety Institute?
It is, and thanks in good part to Alliance Tutoring. There are a few other organizations. Alliance Tutoring is great, but there are other good ones too. But what Alliance does so well, and I'm deeply critical of programs like yours, Alex, because academic programs popping up all the time. Tutoring, academic coaching, clinical academics, all these fancy terms. But really where the rubber meets the road is an academic program that will really partner with the program that has experience working with students who are in treatment, in outpatient treatment. I mean, that's a very unique experience to have. And that, most importantly, can provide in-person tutoring, remote tutoring, in-home tutoring, in-school tutoring. I mean, to have that, to be able to, because, to go into all those different environments, it's so in line with our exposure protocol, where first, a student might only be ready or open to doing in-person, like on-site academics. We call it sort of AI-bound instruction, Anxiety Institute-bound instruction, where Alliance Tutor and Alliance Tutor will come to our center and be doing that academic work on-site, because the student wouldn't do it at home. They're not at that stage of treatment where they can do it independently and or with you know, less support and supervision remotely, let's say. So what you guys do great is match the academic intervention with what the student is ready for, which is so linked to their clinical treatment plan and ultimately their outcome.
Absolutely. And I, you know, and I think one of the things too that we pride ourselves on is being able to develop a rapport with those students in the IOP, which I feel like is really fundamental. If you don't have that relationship of trust with them, then it makes it essentially impossible to broach very difficult, you know, subjects that are filled with terror for some of them in particular. So really, I kind of consider that sort of inherent in our mission. And really the first step when we are encountering a kid that's doing the IOP. So another question, do you find it easier to work with kids that are coming from a public school system or a private school system? Which one's easier for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've never been asked that, actually. I don't think it makes much of a difference. There are certainly times where a student is coming for treatment over the summer and they are returning to a boarding school, let's say in Virginia or Vermont, and you know, it's quite a ways from Madison, New Jersey or Greenwich, but, and we would like to have more access locally to them. It doesn't mean those students don't do extremely well, and we provide really good remote aftercare for those students. But as long as the school is open to working with us, really, that's what's important. And public schools, especially since COVID, have been really pretty great, most of them, at being flexible with the schedule, providing financial support to pay for Alliance tutoring, which I understand that, is that still happening?
Like, so yeah, the public schools generally will fund what's called homebound instruction. They're required to by the state. We've always been funded by Connecticut schools. We've never been turned away by Connecticut schools. There's about 5% of cases in, you know, New York, New Jersey, you know, where the school will refuse to pay, but in an overwhelming majority of cases, about 95% of the time, they will fund it. So obviously that's a load off for the parents. You know, we kind of, that can be a huge relief when they're facing really what's a crisis, family crisis.
And paying a lot for treatment too, you know, and to think, oh, I've got to pay for another, you may not want to publish this, but Fusion Academy of $50,000 plus the cost of my program. Yeah, that could be a lot. So I know that that's really helped a lot of families that we work with and move forward with treatment, is not only knowing that they get to work with Alliance, that we're going to work together, but the public school is more likely than not to pay for your services.
When these clients transition out of the program, where are they going? Are they going in back into traditional schools typically, into residential programs, outdoor programs, therapeutic boarding schools? What?
Yeah, so unlike a wilderness program or a residential treatment program, a student is more likely than not to go to a therapeutic boarding school or a non-traditional boarding school. It's sort of a safer bet. But with students that come to us, the vast majority, but I'm sort of estimating that it'll be, at least, you know, 80% will return to the public or private school that they came from. 20% will go to a different school. Could be not a therapeutic. It might be just another traditional private school or a public school that has better special education resources or is closer to what they need, basically.
Yeah, and I would add too that in I would say about 50% of cases we do transition with the kids that are leaving the IOP to maintain continuity, mainly in a lot of those cases because the kids have developed such a strong relationship with the tutors, you know, and coaches that they rely on them as sort of a mentor, a figure of stability that really helps them make what can be a tough transition if they're moving schools or geographies or both, that can be extraordinarily helpful.
Well, Alex, I'm pleased to say that because a big reason of why we have partnered with you, and certainly we work with other tutoring academic companies, but it's seldom. And the reason is that the continuity of care and continuity of professionals is so important. Of course, during treatment, but after treatment is equally important. And a student that goes through our two-month program, they are continuing after that with an hour of therapy a week with the same clinician that they worked with in IOP. They're continuing to work with the same tutor from Alliance Tutoring. They have this team that is not going to quit until there is lasting recovery.
Exactly. And I mean, that's what it's all about, right? I mean, as we talked about earlier, it's about predictability. It's about that feeling of safety that is necessary to be able to face those things that are entirely terrifying, right? And causing those behaviors of avoidance and escape.
Yeah. Well, you're really careful with who you hire, as we are. And that is really critical, because you want people that are going to be very dependable, that can adapt to individual needs of your students, of our clients. There's neurodiversity among our population and yours. And what that looks like is maybe, you know, high functioning on the spectrum, high functioning ASD, some executive functioning issues. Yeah, and you do really well with, and we collaborate together, both, you know, clinically and educationally. So that continuity is especially important for those students, because they've seen so many people in their life, professionals, that if this is working, this must continue.
Exactly. Now, do you find that, you know, many of your clients are kind of somewhere in the college process? If so, you know, why do you think that is? And what is kind of your desired outcome in those situations? What kind of results do you see when you're talking about kids who are sort of in between high school and college, perhaps?
So we have two age groups. We work with 13 to 18-year-olds, and then, well, 13 to 17-year-olds. We work with 13 to 17-year-olds and 18 to 28-year-olds. We actually go up to 25, but recently there's been a few students between 25 and 28 that have been a good fit. So of that older group, the 18 to 25 group, there are probably about 3/4 are college students. They either have been admitted and they're taking a gap year. They attended college for a semester or a year and then taking medical leave, which, by the way, is something that I always recommend. Don't withdraw. Try to take a medical leave, or at least reach out to us or a clinician you're working with to see if you have evidence to do that, because it will protect your child's future.
If you don't have the withdrawal on your transcript?
Yeah, the medical leave protects you, can protect your grades. You can get sort of incompletes versus fails.
Which you can fill in later. The incompletes sometimes are temporary place markers.
Often, yeah. And thanks, you know, with your help, we have students that will be, you know, leaving the semester, let's say in October, coming to do treatment, and we've communicated and with the university, and they've allowed us for that student to do that work remotely. The student thought it was all, you know, everything was being destroyed, and then they'd have to.
Yeah, that's one of the first questions we ask is, you know, how can we maintain a pristine transcript? You know, are there any way? And that's really one of the first things that we would probe the school or college about is, you know, how can we maintain the transcript, which we've been able to do. And the vast majority of cases, generally schools are, you know, open to that conversation.
And I want parents to hear this. If the parents listen to this, I want you to know that it's not just maintaining the transcript. That's super important. But it's, we need to maintain that transcript will help our treatment, because it's real life exposure. It's variables that will elicit anxiety that we need to induce to elicit desensitization, grit, determination, everything that you want back. So moving forward on the college students, there's some that have actually just finished college and they really need, you know, targeted, they were able to get through, but they still need targeted anxiety work. And then they need some independent living skills, some transitional living support, help with an internship or interviewing for a job or applying to grad school, or really nurturing independence is a lot of the work that we do, whatever the age of the student, because anxiety creates codependence. Yeah, we work very commonly. We've got a wonderful cohort of college students in our Boca Raton site, Greenwich, Connecticut, and Madison, New Jersey. We are opening a site in McLean, Virginia in 6 weeks. I want everyone to know that we have students coming from around the world, around the country, to each of those sites. They don't just serve local or regional clients.
Just coincidentally, I was going to say those cases, just in my observation, have actually gone very well. I don't know if it's because they're, you know, in relocating there, they're creating a sort of an environment, you know, that's kind of conducive to facing anxiety. But for some reason, those relocation cases tend to go very well.
Yeah, I think they got a lot of confidence from leaving the home and, you know, by doing an intensive day program, but traveling to it like a destination, you know, IOP, we are able to create like this in this independent life. Increasingly, yes, the parent is going to be there for a younger child, but we can control and grade that exposure. And a lot of our kids do go back to college, obviously, you know, just people that are applying now. Most of them are thinking they're going back in September, and they realize, you know, I only want to do this once. I want to do it right. Let's take a gap semester. You know, this is all going to be good for your resume. It's going to be a wonderful experiential, emotional journey that's going to help you for the rest of your life. But yeah, it's about treatment. We can market it later in the way it needs to be marketed. But let's take a semester and prove that you're ready to return in January versus hedge that you're ready.
Yeah, and I would say too, with our, you know, our college transition service, I think is conducive to that college experience. What we do is really, you know, work with them on analyzing the syllabi to begin with, and developing a relationship with their professors. You know, obviously study skills and, you know, executive function skills, like breaking a larger paper into component parts, thesis, topic, sentences, and you know, the track record with doing that kind of college transition service, which is very difficult, I would say, for kids who have had everything kind of handed to them from an executive function skill, you know, throughout the sort of lower school years. Those kids, you know, gain a lot of confidence in, you know, learning how do you talk to your professor? How do you write a college essay and do the research that's involved for that? How do you manage your own life when you're entirely independent? So
those are skills that Alliance Tutoring provides and are critical, you know, for the treatment process, for the work that we're doing collaboratively.
Here are a few things that stuck out to me after the second segment of my conversation with Dan. You know, the kids that they are looking at really center their sort of experience around academics, makes sense. You know, school is their main challenge, the main sort of measuring stick for their ego, their success, how they're doing. You know, it's all determined by grade level, like how old you are. Is you're in 11th, 12th grade, that's how they define themselves. It's sort of a central part in his mind of their therapy, seems to make sense. Every case varies as far as the trigger points go. Some of them are directly academic. Some are far more tangentially, but the academic experience is at the heart of all student experience at that age. Another thing that stuck out to me in the second portion of my conversation then was his analogy to rehabilitation and sort of thinking about it in terms of the sports world. If you've broken your arm and you're, you know, getting back into playing hockey or whatever the case may be, you need to be able to do some modified version of the sport before you really jump back into it again. And thinking about academic components, really you need a sort of simulated version of that world that you're going to be re-entering when you graduate from an IOP like this. The moment that they start, that they initiate with Anxiety Institute, with an IOP, it's rehabilitation. How has the sort of post-pandemic, or the resolution, I guess, of some of those pandemic issues, how has that impacted the work at Anxiety Institute? Has it changed kind of the approach or the feel of the work that's done there?
I wouldn't say that it changes the approach. Our approach is based on evidence, empirical support from peer-reviewed journals that will stand the test of time. What does change is how we might adapt that scientifically proven effective intervention with either the length of treatment. We might customize the treatment program more post-pandemic. In reality, we see this as post-pandemic period of time, where a pandemic was everything from, you know, quarantine to kind of a year after, which was really difficult for everyone. But in this period, yeah, sort of adapting to what individually might be needed clinically, being a little more flexible outside of this fixed 8-week program. And we did shift more to intensive targeted treatment from 2 hours a week to 4 hours a day. more independent living skills, occupational psychology or rehabilitation counseling is sort of the professional fields within the field of psychology that focus on transitioning from adolescence to adulthood and a dependent, maybe adult to an independent adult. So we're doing a lot more of that work in partnership with you guys, actually, with Alliance.
I mean, maybe I can just ask this question too in a slightly different way. You know, do you still see residual effects of the pandemic in the clientele you're seeing right now? And really, what are those?
Yeah. Wow. That's a good question. For some, yeah, it's trauma. For some, it's a traumatic experience, not just the COVID or maybe the fear of COVID. For some, it might be because that became a specific phobia. But a lot of it, the residual effects are the traumatic experience of the impact that COVID had on my life. The traumatic experiences of the things that I really lost or I felt that I could have gained, it really threw everyone off, you know? So we are. I would say things are really settled, more settled and stabilized, that we have a few students out of our cohort, so maybe let's say 2 out of 15 in each program that still have an acute fear of COVID or getting a health condition. So they've developed a sort of health anxiety profile triggered by COVID. We're not seeing any sort of long COVID and we're not a medical hospital setting, so maybe we're not the best place for that. But we're seeing a lot of recovery and stabilization, not just from our treatment, because things in the world have stabilized in that area, at least.
Makes it a bit easier. But I imagine a lot of these kids can trace their conditions, their clinical conditions, back to the pandemic still. Are there trends you're noticing that students and parents should be aware of at this point?
A couple. One trend is a sharp increase in the rates of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, which is sort of by definition, the obsession is a fear of something. Compulsion is either a behavior or a thought to decrease the anxiety that comes with that obsession. So a classic compulsion is, you know, I'm going to wash my hands for fear of contamination. But we're seeing a real increase in intrusive thought OCD, which is just mental compulsions, which are unwanted, intrusive thoughts. They can have a bizarre nature. It could be an intrusive thought that I'm going to hurt someone or I'm going to hurt myself. Or it could be a mystical or magical type intrusive thought, and they'll look a little delusional and your child will struggle kind of sharing what they are, and they'll be terrified and think they're going crazy. But it's the thought of, if I think it, it could happen or could be real. There's intrusive thoughts related to sexual orientation and gender identity.
And you've seen an increase in gender identity, that anxiety as well, right?
We've seen an increase in, an increase of OCD by 300%, of intrusive thought OCD by 300%. So a three-times increase of intrusive thought OCD or bad thought OCD. A lot of people don't know what that is. You can kind of look it up. Bad thought OCD, then mental compulsions, intrusive thoughts that come with a lot of anxiety, and you'll read about it. But in regards to gender identity, so one of the domains that can occur in intrusive thought OCD is intrusive thoughts of homosexuality, or, you know, am I gay, or I could be, or how do I know? And no different than what if I drop this and hurt someone, or what if I do something terrible? And there's all these different types of OCD. And certainly in regards to gender identity, yes, that because of the social cultural awareness and acceptance of that, certainly students are exploring and feel safe to explore gender identity. But there is a part of OCD where they'll question, you know, am I a woman? Am I man? Am I gay? Am I straight? And it's typically actually not correlated with a real uncertainty. It's just in their mind, what's the worst thing that I could think of? You know, I could molest this child. We'll hear a child say that, and it's like, they would never do anything. That's just the worst thing they can think of. And it will be destroying their life, and they'll have these thoughts that they can't control, and they'll go to a psychiatric hospital and be diagnosed with delusional disorder or schizophrenia. Or those cases do exist very rarely, but you really want to check, is there a fear component? Do they realize that fear is irrational?
Well, you know, it's like the classic J.P. Sartre scenario where, you know, he asks, why is it that we're afraid of standing at the top of a really, really steep cliff that's got like 5,000-foot drop? The answer is, of course, that you could jump. That is the most terrifying part of that.
Gosh, you're going to have to send that to me because that's...
Right. That's terrifying if I engage that thought and put myself at the top of that cliff, but us in our imaginations, I think, can maybe have step back away from the cliff.
And could you imagine that a lot of the students that we work with, it's not, will I jump if I go to the top of that cliff? It's, will I do 100 things? It's following them around. It's not, I need to go somewhere. These thoughts haunting me, and that I could do these terrible things that could destroy my life and others. And they will be sometimes so convinced that it's real. And that's why treatment at this level is so critical.
Exactly. So if you had one sort of parting piece of advice for, you know, parents or your, perhaps even kids who are facing these issues of clinical anxiety, what would that piece of parting advice be?
I would say, and I often bring it back because it is a core mission of the Anxiety Institute, is we really do not want anxiety to interfere with access to treatment. And what I mean by that is if someone has a pretty severe anxiety disorder, they are going to have fear, doubt, and some resistance to sometimes any treatment, let alone an intensive day program. But I want parents to know, or any listeners to know, that it's a process. By a child talking to me or someone at the Anxiety Institute or Alex Merrill about academics, it doesn't mean they have to do this. We want to make a decision. We want our clients to make decisions based on reason, not fear. What they know versus what they don't, based on experience versus not having that experience. Let's make informed decisions so that anxiety and fear doesn't get in the way of the treatment and the academic support our clients need.
Totally. And, you know, and in my experience too, the way that it's rolled out and their sort of buy-in really might be the most critical component to success. If they're locked in, if they're committed, if they're, you know, feel like it's their own volition, I think that their chances of success are astronomically higher.
Yeah, no, we'll hear from parents that my child's not motivated. They're not going to benefit from it. That's their fear talking. We're going to assess on a day-to-day basis. Like if we will know after a week, 7 to 10 days, if this is working and we can turn extrinsic motivation into intrinsic motivation. But without that opportunity, like give us that opportunity, give your child the chance for treatment. Let's not get fear in the way, because the outcome can be transformative.
And I would say personal relationships are at the heart of that as well. If you have somebody who you feel, you know, believes in you, if you have a set of circumstances where you feel like you can succeed, I think that makes all the difference in the world. Here are some final thoughts after my conversation with Dr. Dan. I found it interesting that he mentioned in particular that there was a 300% increase in cases of obsessive compulsive disorder following the pandemic. And that does make sense. Now I think about it, those kids are now struggling. We now are developing more acute models for dealing with kids like that in an academic setting. We've certainly learned a lot in the last few years after having so many of those kids in our care. I think the future is bright for those kids. You know, I think once they develop a sort of a situation where they have an adult they can trust, they have a great therapeutic program that is also providing them support, they can begin to develop a sort of tolerance to some of the things that are really plaguing them underneath. Another thing that stuck out to me in my conversation with Dan was the theme of mentorship and really how important that relationship can be with the academic tutor alongside the therapist. I mean, I think it's fairly obvious that you want that type of relationship with the therapist. I think that's critical to success. But also having that, I think, with a tutor is an academic professional that can then sort of bridge the gap between what they're doing in the IOP and in the next stage. That relationship is really critical to a successful reintegration. It's great that, you know, that all of our tutors you know, our masters and PhDs and, you know Chaucer very well and everything. But when we're, you know, looking to hire in our organization, the first thing we're looking for is, you know, the tutors that are going to be able to create that type of relationship, that have that type of personality, that have got that kind of experience work with students of that kind. You know, step one, two, and three for us is really establishing that relationship. Another thing that stuck out to me as a theme in our conversation really is the impact of the various manifestations of escapism and avoidance. I think it can take on a lot of different, perhaps deceiving forms, because there are so many, you know, mechanisms that human beings can use to get out of something that's uncomfortable. And he even described it as being somewhat of a drug, because you can sort of reinforce that as a way to escape uncomfortable feelings and reinforce that. So, and if you can recognize that for what it is and attach it to that anxiety, that's when you can go about curing that, healing that through exposure. Shining the light on those behaviors can be very liberating for both the student themselves and for the parent. Thanks for listening to Highway to Higher Ed, the podcast that helps the parents of today's rising college stars navigate the obstacles in college admissions to find the best possible college match and help them thrive once they get there. If you like this episode, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.